Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Raj, for the introduction. Today I'm going to talk about key advances and remaining knowledge gaps in remote sensing for precision agriculture. I want to start out by saying I'm by no means an expert in remote sensing. I have used remote sensing in precision agriculture since about 1989. But there are many people in the room, I'm sure, who know much more about remote sensing than I do. And what I want to do today is give you a broad overview of how remote sensing is used in precision agriculture and what I see as some of the key knowledge gaps. And to do this, I've relied heavily on some of my colleagues from around the world who I have learned a lot about remote sensing from. So as Raj said, we do have a lot of challenges facing agriculture, including the need to feed a large and growing population, lack of land, climate change, and some environmental challenges. And precision agriculture is really developed to address some of these challenges. It's a management practice applied at the right time and right place in the right amount. And it involves field or sub-region management of nutrients, irrigation, drainage, pests, weeds, tillage, or seeding. Precision agriculture really started out as a sort of information management system where we would collect data, we would use that data to actually develop information about better crop and soil management, we would analyze the data, try to understand what it means, make decisions about management practices, implement those management practices, and generate optimal resource management. So in this process of data collection, information generation, knowledge, and wisdom, what we're trying to do is manage our resources more efficiently, produce food, fuel, fiber, feed, fun, and other things that are happening on the land. And through this process, we really want to, help change the way that farming manages the landscape and produces food for the human population. Now, there were several ideas about how precision agriculture should be implemented. When we first started, way back in the early 80s, I think most people were thinking about farming by soil. Then another school of thought came into being, which is more grid sampling-based management, where you actually took soil samples and used those to make management decisions. And then later on, we had a third sort of general category of philosophy, which involved trying to use real-time sensors to make management decisions on the go. So we've kind of made the transition from map-based, whether it was soil or grid soil-based maps to real-time on-the-go maps, and as a result, I think our sensors have also changed over time. But remote sensing certainly plays a very big role in data management, data collection, data analysis, and that's kind of the part of this that I want to focus in on today. We have to keep in mind that there are many, many ways of collecting data, and remote sensing is not the only tool that we have. Remote sensing should always be combined with other types of data collection, including soil sampling or yield monitoring. Remote sensing involves the electromagnetic spectrum, and this diagram shows the range of the electromagnetic spectrum which is available for remote sensing. Most of the remote sensing applications in precision agriculture involve the visible spectrum and the infrared spectrum. Remote sensing can be used when you're talking about bare soils to measure things like soil organic carbon, soil moisture, iron oxides or carbonates. Remote sensing can also be applied to the crops to measure leaf area index, crop growth stage, crop color and leaf end status, weeds and disease. And if you're interested in water relations, we can use thermal emission of energy through thermal infrared remote sensing to detect surface temperature and crop water stress. There are two other kinds of remote sensing that I won't talk much about today. One is LIDAR-based sensing of elevation and topography, and another is fluorescence spectroscopy. There are lots of papers on fluorescence spectroscopy in the sessions in the next couple of days. So remote sensing applications in precision agriculture typically involve mapping crop variability, including crop growth, biomass, and yield, crop phenology and evapotranspiration, crop stresses due to nutrients, disease, weeds, and insects. We can also map soil variability. We can use remote sensing to identify the best locations to take soil samples through targeted sampling. Remote sensing has been used to delineate management zones. And with remote sensing, we have the ability to monitor changes over time. Here are some examples of some actual remote sensing products from an article in Remote Sensing of Environment. And you can see that, with remote sensing, you can identify things like fertilizer skips. You can identify areas that are drowned out. But more importantly, maybe for precision agriculture, you can take a satellite image of a sugar beet field, for example, just before harvest, and the chlorophyll in the leaves will give you a different reflectance depending on the biomass. So the greener areas have more biomass than the lighter green areas, and that can be used to indicate the amount of nitrogen that's present in the biomass, which will be carried over to the next year. And you can make nitrogen management maps for sugar beets. And in fact, this type of approach is being widely used in sugar beet production throughout Minnesota and the Dakotas. And so it's one of the probably most significant applications of remote sensing that exists today in precision agriculture. Now, remote sensing has been around a long time. It started in the middle 1800s when cameras were placed on hot air balloons. Some people started putting cameras on pigeons around 1900. That didn't work too well because the pigeons couldn't really be controlled too well. The pitch and the yaw of the pigeon was kind of complicated. So when airplanes were developed, cameras were put on airplanes, and that was a lot more stable and more controllable than a pigeon. The age of satellites came about with Sputnik and the U.S. space program. Landsat was launched in 1970, and then a whole range of satellite platforms were developed, culminating in today's very modern, advanced satellites that have high spatial and spectral resolution. And so if you go through time and look at the satellites that had an application in precision agriculture, Landsat was certainly the first. And it had green, red, two infrared bands, and a spatial resolution of about 30 meters or so. The return frequency is about 18 days. And because of the long return frequency and the low spatial resolution, this has a relatively low suitability for applications of the type we're interested in today with precision agriculture. As time passed, satellites became more suitable. So, for example, Spot has a 2 to 6 day return frequency, a 20 meter spatial resolution. So this is probably something that would be moderate in terms of its usefulness for precision agriculture. We really had an explosion around the turn of the millennium with Iconos and QuickBird, and then later on RapidEye, GeoEye, and WorldView. Generally speaking, these satellites began to have quicker return frequencies, higher spatial resolutions, and they were much more suitable, high suitability for use with precision agriculture applications. Today, we have things like WorldView, which gives us blue, green, red, yellow, red edge, near-infrared reflectance. with a one-day return frequency and really has a very high potential suitability for use in precision agriculture. Another major development was the hyperspectral remote sensing satellite Hyperion, which provided information about the entire visible and part of the infrared spectrum in very, very narrow bandwidths, about 10 nanometers. The spatial resolution was 30 meters, and the return frequency was about 16 days. So this product really opened people's eyes to the possibility of not only looking at the traditional, you know, green, red, and near-infrared bands, but also looking at very discrete bands where there was a lot of information about different biochemical and biophysical properties of the crop and soil. So we've seen a trend towards increasing spatial resolution of these satellites, starting out in the 60s with maybe pixel sizes of a kilometer, and today we have pixel sizes of a meter or less. So generally speaking, we've gone from a kilometer down to a meter or less in terms of spatial resolution with these different products. And this is very important when it comes to classifying and interpreting images. If your image is a kilometer on a side, there's a lot of different information included in that kilometer. You could have different types of crops. You could have bare soil. You could have water. And a 1 kilometer pixel is going to average all of that together, and you will not be able to really distinguish the different parts of that, image. By going to smaller and smaller pixels, you have the ability then to discriminate smaller and smaller features that could be managed using precision agriculture. Now, we've discovered a lot of limitations to remote sensing by satellites. The initial satellites had coarse spatial resolution and infrequent repeat coverage. It was difficult to obtain images when you needed them at critical growth stages when you wanted to make a certain management decision. Satellites could not see through clouds, and they had changes in irradiance on multiple passes. You had to do corrections for atmospheric interference and changes in radiance. There was slow turnaround time due to image processing for calibration, corrections, and georectification. And cost was also somewhat of a limitation. Today's satellite imagery costs generally from $23 to $45 per square kilometer, but you have to acquire fairly large scenes when you're doing this. So there has been a lot more interest recently in using aerial remote sensing through the use of airplanes or unmanned aerial vehicles. Japan, for example, through the research of Noboru Noguchi and other people, developed very large fleets of helicopters that are used extensively to manage agricultural inputs on the island of Hokkaido. There are many companies now that provide aerial remote sensing services throughout the U.S. and the world. We developed in Minnesota a small unmanned aerial vehicle that used a sail, and we could take imagery using that. So there's a lot of interest in this because you can control when these fly, you can fly under clouds, you can do the type of processing you want when you want it. Here are some images we took with our small Pixie unit showing the spatial resolution that's available. These are check strips with no nitrogen. This is a quick bird image from the same time showing very much the same kind of pattern. And this is a yield map which we took at the end of the year. Another, as I mentioned, approach in remote sensing applications is what I call proximal remote sensing or real-time remote sensing, where sensors are mounted on tractors, spreaders, sprayers, or irrigation booms. Examples of these would be green seeker, crop circle, weed seeker, and infrared thermometers. This allows real-time site-specific management of fertilizer, pesticides, or irrigation. Now, how do you interpret all these images? You know, this is really a big issue, and we've made a lot of advances in data interpretation. There's a famous article by Marv Bauer, who's the technical editor for Remote Sensing of Environment, on different methods for classification of images. So we have supervised and unsupervised classification, decision tree classifiers like CART, neural network classification, fuzzy sets, and use of auxiliary information, which is really the newest thing in classification. So you can take a soil map or some other piece of auxiliary information to improve your classification. Pattern detection is also something that, where there's been a lot of advances in terms of image differencing, cross-correlation, chemometric analysis, principal component analysis, neural networks, object-oriented classification, fuzzy set theory. One of the key advances is really in chemometric analysis, where we're really interested in trying to identify which spectral indices and which wavelengths are important, which indices and spectral bands contain the information that we need to make decisions. And finally, then, there's been a lot of progress in assessing accuracy of remote sensing through things like Kappa statistics and confusion matrices, for example. So here are just a few images on classification. We have some images. We want to know what those images mean in terms of crop systems or soil types or stressed areas. So we go through a system where we, you know, divide the different parts of the image into different classes based on the spectral response. That was the traditional method. The more recent approach is really to use fuzzy classification, which recognizes that a single pixel may actually belong to more than one class. And so you can represent the range of membership of a particular pixel rather than thinking of it as a discrete identity. Spectral decomposition and chemometrics are used now widely to help identify the best spectral indices and wavelengths. There are a number of techniques used here, mixing analysis, principal component, partial least squares regression, stepwise multiple linear regression, multivariate adaptive regression splines, etc. In spectral mixing, you attempt to decompose the information in a particular pixel using a linear combination of weighting factors, as shown here, to split the image into its end members. So, for instance, crop and soil could be separated. Principal component analysis is widely used to simplify the interpretation of reflectance spectra and to identify which wavelengths have similar relationships to one another. They're all put into the same component loading or loading factors. Neural network methods are used to predict relationships. So you take an input layer, which could be remote sensing, and you try to predict some type of output layer, such as nitrogen stress. And in between, you have a mathematical set of weighting factors and transfer functions that are used to, with proper calibration, to generate your output layer. Another major advance is in accuracy assessment. The old way of doing accuracy assessment did not consider spatial location. So as long as the same number of pixels were represented in the calibration and the validation data set, it was deemed okay without really looking at where those pixels were located. More importantly for precision ag is identifying boundaries between management zones. And so the spatial location is very important when it comes to accuracy assessment. The confusion matrix is widely used in remote sensing to try and understand how accurate your predictions are. So if you have ground truth data and you can put your measurements into different classes, say for nitrogen stress levels, and you can compare those to predictions from remote sensing with, say, particular wavelengths, you can come up with the number of pixels that are in each of these different classes of the matrix. And you can compute statistics relating to you know, omission errors and commission errors. Omission errors involve underestimation or underprediction of a class. Commission errors involve overestimation of a class. And we can develop accuracy assessments, either for the user or the producer, errors of commission and omission, and overall accuracy by tabulating these statistics. Here's an example from the research that we're doing in Minnesota with remote sensing of nitrogen stress in potatoes. This was developed by my graduate student, Tyler Nygon, who's here in the audience. So here we have leaf nitrogen as an index of nitrogen stress, and we can put the crop into categories. Here we have our predictions of nitrogen stress using a spectral index called DCNI. And we can then look at how many, what percent of the, predictions were in the wrong class. We can look at, on this side we have a 14% commission error. Here we have a 17% commission error, omission error for this class here. So, and overall we have a 70% accuracy. So basically, anytime you're off the diagonal in terms of these cells, it means you've made a mistake. Either you're overestimating or you're underestimating a class. So the ideal situation would be to have all of your pixels falling along the diagonal. With remote sensing, you can estimate biophysical or biochemical variables. This is an example of some research from Saudi Arabia through the courtesy of Dr. Patil and Dr. Al-Ghadi from King Saud University, where they used remote sensing to estimate the NDVI of an irrigated wheat crop. And you can see basically two classes, a high NDVI and a lower NDVI. And through ground truthing, they were able to show that the NDVI measurements from remote sensing were very strongly related to the leaf area index of the crop. And this could be used to develop management zones, for example. So we're interested in identifying spatial patterns with remote sensing and the characteristics of how those patterns are connected or what their shape or size is. Those are all very important when it comes to making decisions. When we have hyperspectral data, which involves collecting remote sensing reflectance in many, many, many different bands for an entire field, so here we have X and Y locations with different bands, we basically can create maps such as this for every band, and that becomes then a very big data challenge. So we have to use some kind of geographic information system to really process all the data and try to make sense of it. We also have to use some type of statistical analysis to summarize what we found. There are traditional methods through mean and dispersion or histograms, but more and more people are using spatial and non-traditional statistics, including Kalman filtering, homogeneity measures, contrast or dissimilarity, and of course geostatistics, which I've worked on quite a bit in my career. Geostatistics can be used to correct errors in remote sensing images. Sometimes you have a remote sensing image and you look at it after it was taken and you say, oh no, there was a cloud in the middle of my field. What do I do now? Well, there are techniques to get around that. So here, for example, is a Landsat image that has serious errors because of the failure of part of the equipment on the Landsat satellite. Through geostatistics, you can actually fill in those missing pixels. If you have cloud cover, you can also do the same thing as shown in a paper by one of my former students. Geostatistics involves spatial modeling and interpolation. Spatial modeling is done with a semivariogram, which tells you how the variance changes as a function of separation distance. We can use variograms either in co-kriging or in kriging to do spatial interpolation, where we're trying to predict the value at an unsampled location using the spatial model. The difference between kriging and co-kriging is that kriging uses only a single measured parameter to make the interpolation, whereas co-kriging uses two variables, a primary and an auxiliary variable, The auxiliary variable helps to improve the prediction accuracy. Here's an example of some remote sensing work we did with Kriegen and Co-Kriegen on a wheat field in Washington State. So here's a wheat field with where we sampled the soil to measure available phosphorus. We used the data to make a map of phosphorus levels. And obviously where you have low soil test phosphorus, phosphorus fertilizer would need to be applied. When we look at using a remote sensing image of the same field and combining that with a soil sampling, we can use co-kriegen to vastly improve the level of detail about the spatial patterns in phosphorus. So you can see with kriegen and with co-kriegen, there's a lot more detail about where these deficient locations are on the field. We can also use remote sensing along with soil sampling to identify the optimal locations for taking soil samples. So here's some targeted soil sampling research we did where we used a bare soil near-infrared image to identify regions that were significantly different in soil organic matter content. And we could then, put our soil samples in locations where we would get information about the natural soil variability. This is much more efficient than going out and doing grid sampling. So in the same field, we did hyper-intensive soil sampling on a very, very fine scale and then made maps showing, for example, phosphorus concentrations. In contrast, the targeted sampling strategy gives us a very similar spatial map for soil phosphorus without going to the difficulty of taking all these samples. So it really improves the efficiency of, your information processing. And it's much better than something like a regular grid sample, which basically leads to an incorrect map in this particular case. Applications of remote sensing in precision agriculture include crop growth stages, leaf area index, biomass, yield, chlorophyll, nitrogen stress, weeds, disease, salinity, delineated management zones, and then precision conservation. There have been many crop sensors developed over the course of time. The SPAD meter was used by Shepherds to start looking at nitrogen deficiency in corn. This uses reflectance at 650 and 940 nanometers. The Blackmer and Shepherds then developed nitrogen sufficiency indices. In Oklahoma, researchers started looking at optical sensors for on-the-go detection of variability. This led to development of commercial sensors like the Yara N sensor, Green Seeker, Crop Circle, all of which use slightly different approaches, algorithms, and wavelengths for detecting nitrogen stress. And then there were some hyperspectral sensors developed as well that looked at the whole spectrum. So when you look at the whole spectrum, you see, the traditional spectrum of a growing plant is for high absorbance in the red part of the spectrum, and you have very high reflectance in the near infrared portion, and this is very different from the reflectance spectrum for brown vegetation or for soil. So you can then use remote sensing to detect not only the status of the crop, but also where crop is growing, where soil is located, and things of that nature. With remote sensing, there are specific absorption bands for chlorophyll that are very important. Chlorophyll absorbs in very distinct segments in the red and blue, and there's higher reflectance in the green and the near infrared. If you look at the infrared part of the spectrum, there are several atmospheric water absorption bands where you can't get much information, especially through remote sensing by satellites. But some of these wavelengths are very useful for thermal sensing of crop stress. So if you look in more detail at the absorption spectrum of different pigments in plants, you see distinct peaks where they absorb strongly and other areas where they reflect most of the radiation. And this allows us to really use remote sensing to estimate biochemical and biophysical features of crops. You can also distinguish soil from crops by looking at red versus near-infrared reflectance. Crops typically change in this ratio as they mature. When they germinate, they may be over here. As they grow, they tend to mature and end up more on this part of the spectrum over here. So the ratio of near-infrared to red reflectance is a moving target. It changes over time with a growing crop. Satellite remote sensing is widely used around the world for precision agriculture. These are some figures given by Dr. Yuxin Miao, one of my former students. And they're using remote sensing for nitrogen management of rice in China. They're classifying rice fields into deficient, normal, and excessive at either the field or the village level, and really making a huge difference in nitrogen management. They're also using crop sensor-based nitrogen management strategies to identify what the optimum N rate is. Producers in China traditionally apply very high rates of nitrogen, which don't lead to additional increases in yield and severely damage the environment. So with remote sensing-based methods, Yuxin and his colleagues have been showing that you can improve the efficiency of nitrogen fertilizer without affecting the yield. There are many spectral indices used in remote sensing. Canopy reflectance is affected by water, chlorophyll, canopy density, age of the crop, soil, etc. In 1981, Jackson developed this crop water stress index to indicate leaf water potential and leaf temperature. Rouse developed an NDVI, normalized difference vegetative index, in 1974. There's been development on indices to adjust for the soil that shows through when you take images of canopies, a modified soil adjusted vegetative index, for example. And then there are specific indices designed to look at chlorophyll, like the modified chlorophyll absorption ratio index. These all use slightly different wavelengths. With regards to crop water stress, thermal remote sensing is very useful at identifying areas where you might have water stress in fields just by looking at leaf temperature. This is also being used by researchers in Israel, by courtesy of Victor Alchanatis and Yafit Cohen. They provided these images of red, green, blue images of a potato field. And here is the corresponding thermal infrared image. You can see very clearly the difference between the rows and the canopies, and within the canopies, differences in temperature. And they develop a neat technique to mask out the soil by using these red, green, blue images of the canopy, so they can then look at only the vegetated pixels when they try to determine leaf temperature, for example. These types of results can then be used to develop an irrigation scheduling plan for, you know, water management. So we do have different kinds of reflectance spectra. We have panchromatic reflectance. We have broadband or multispectral reflectance at a few specific discrete wavelengths, typically blue, green, red, and near-infrared. And then we have hyperspectral reflectance at specific narrow bands across a large continuous spectrum. Multispectral broadband vegetative indices are listed on this slide here. We have NDVI, green NDVI, soil-adjusted vegetative indices. Again, they all use slightly different wavelengths. Most people today are interested in hyperspectral remote sensing, which gives you images of a field at literally, you know, dozens of wavelengths, ranging from maybe purple all the way into the near-infrared. So you get a tremendous amount of information about the spectral reflectance at discrete wavelengths. What is the best wavelength to use? Well, according to Fenkebale, who's really an expert in this, there are only a few wavelengths that have a lot of information about, you know, crop biochemical and biophysical properties. The longer red wavelengths, the shorter green wavelengths, the red edge, which is very important, and near-infrared. The information in these bands is only available in narrow increments of 10 to 20 nanometers, and our older satellites generally collect in wider bandwidths, which don't allow the full information that's in these regions to be discriminated. The best information of narrow bands in NDVI-like indices is centered in the red and near-infrared, but it varies depending on the type of crop as well as the plant characteristic of interest. Here are some hyperspectral narrowband vegetative indices available. Simple ratio 1 through, there's now 8 or 12 of them. NDVI, green DVI, NDI1. And these tend to focus more on the red edge part of the spectrum where there's a significant change in the reflectance as you proceed from the visible to the near-infrared. We also have narrowband vegetative indices that focus in on chlorophyll or adjust for soil, and oftentimes you can take the ratios of T-Kari to Osabi, for example, if you want to simultaneously look at chlorophyll and remove the effects of soil. Derivative spectra are becoming more popular. You can take hyperspectral reflectance data and take the slope of the reflectance curve as a function of wavelength. Here's some, again, examples from our research in Minnesota. Tyler Nygon, again, prepared this. And it shows reflectance versus wavelength. So here's the original spectra for the vegetated potato field. And then these lines show the derivative of these raw data. And you can see that the peak here corresponds nicely to the red edge portion of the spectrum. You can also try to identify which wavelengths are the best to use by these lambda-lambda plots. A lambda-lambda plot is a plot of one wavelength versus another. The idea is that you would like to identify two wavelengths that are not correlated to each other when you develop your spectral indices so that you're getting a sort of orthogonal data in your information analysis. If you use spectral indices that have two wavelengths that are highly correlated, you are really not gaining any information. There's a lot of interest in temporal analysis of data and in-season management of nitrogen. We all know that nitrogen-deficient plants have a different reflectance spectra than nitrogen-sufficient plants. The reflectance tends to increase in the green part of the spectrum and decrease in the near-infrared. This is the basis for making a nitrogen sufficiency index where you take the nitrogen, you take the reflectance, say, of a given plot that is perhaps nitrogen deficient and compare its reflectance to a nitrogen sufficient plot. If that ratio is less than 0.95 as a threshold, then the crop is probably deficient in nitrogen. You can see these kind of patterns with your eye, but when you do remote sensing, it's very easy to identify the locations that are really nitrogen deficient as you go from, you know, a chlorophyll meter reading to a nitrogen sufficient index to a sufficiency map. You can see the areas that are deficient shown in red here very clearly using these types of approaches. There are a lot of new indices that are really promising for identifying nitrogen deficiency, especially indices that use wavelengths along the red edge part of the spectrum in combination with the near infrared. In Minnesota, we're using remote sensing, hyperspectral-based remote sensing for nitrogen stress in potatoes. Here's our ground truth data for individual research plots that have a range of nitrogen rates applied. The red colors indicate our control plots with low nitrogen. The blue colors indicate our plots that have sufficient nitrogen. And in between, we have green and yellow, which are deficient. With a hyperspectral index called an NDI2, you see that we get a fairly good match with our ground truth data. We're able to identify the plots that are nitrogen deficient. Those would be the red, the orange, the yellow, and the light blue. And then the question arises, which nitrogen sufficiency indices do you really want to use in these analyses? A lot of people are using NDVI, which we found doesn't work very well for this purpose because it has a very low coefficient of variation and it tends to saturate. So here's our ground truth data, and here's a couple of other indices that work much better than NDVI. They have a higher coefficient of variability. LIDAR is another technique that's being used. I'll have to skip this because I'm running out of time. But it really provides you with the ability to discriminate very fine variations in topography. And we can use this for remote sensing to identify areas where runoff might occur from the fields, where slope steepnesses might be influencing crop production. So I want to conclude then with a few thoughts here. Precision agriculture goes back to the middle of the 1980s, and we started out with sensors for soil organic matter that developed into techniques for satellite aerial and unmanned aerial vehicles, tractors, spreaders, sprayers, and irrigation booms. Our spatial resolution has really improved. The wavelengths in use have also improved in terms of spectral bandwidth. And the red edge reflectance is now available on many commercial satellites. The best spectral indices for nitrogen stress should be robust over crop species, variety, and growth stage. Probably those indices at the right wavelengths with the best R-squared values and the highest CV values would be the best ones to use. The return frequency of satellite remote sensing has improved dramatically, although we still have problems with timeliness, cloud interference, and cost of imagery. There's a lot more interest today in remote sensing with unmanned aerial vehicles. And errors in georectification and geometric correction are now becoming really important because we're trying to look at very small regions of the landscape, and any errors that you make have a big influence on your interpretations. As far as remaining knowledge gaps, I think a lot more work is needed on chemometric methods to assess crop biophysical and biochemical characteristics. We need more work on spectral indices that simultaneously allow for assessment of multiple crop stresses, for example, water, nitrogen, and disease. We can do them individually right now, but we don't have the techniques for fusing approaches and looking at all of these simultaneously. We need higher spatial resolution of aerial remote sensing for early detection of disease rather than after the disease has been widely established. We need sensors for direct estimation of nutrient deficiencies without the use of reference strips. These are kind of problematic right now in many cases. We need better rules, better generalizable solutions perhaps, to take into account the variability of spectral indices and algorithms across year, crop type, variety, and growth stage. We need better integration of remote sensing with automated online soil and crop management decision support systems so that real-time management can be done. So we have progressed from farming by soil to farming by grid cell to farming by management to farming with real-time remote sensing. Now the challenge is really to manage individual plants in real time. I think that's where the future is. Thank you very much for your attention. I think, as Raj mentioned to me earlier, there will be questions following the next keynote, so I will return to my seat now, but I thank you for your attention.